Mr. Mason, real one. Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in London, in Wandsworth, in 1920.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a bank clerk.
And did you go to school in Wandsworth?
No. We left London when I was 3 or 4 years of age, and then we moved to near Southampton. And then my father had a posting to Farringdon in Berkshire. And I first went to school there at the age of 5, small primary school.
Did you grow up in Farringdon?
Yes. All my boyhood, really, until I was just about 14. And then we moved to Weston. So all my schooling was in Farringdon. I only got as far as the ordinary school, you know, the council school, and left there when I was 14. Of course, I had no qualifications at all. Then I came with my parents to Weston, and my first job was, when I left school, as a sort of garage help mechanic, you know, training mechanic. My father then had left the bank, and he'd joined a firm of electricians in the town, and they were looking for apprentices. So after a few months, I left the garage and joined his firm. And then trained as an electrician with the idea that perhaps in years to come, I should myself be an electrical contractor. then after, one might say a quarrel with the owner of the firm, I left and joined another firm in Weston, electricians. And by this time I was, 16 and a half, I suppose. And they sent me to Stafford to wire up a new housing estate that was being built. I was doing quite well, really, there, and I was reasonably happy, although after a time I got bored, and at about September 1938, I think it was during the Munich crisis, I thought that there might be a war. A lot of people thought there might be a war. And I decided to do what basically I'd always really wanted to do, was to join the army. So I gave my notice in and went down to London, went to the old recruiting office in Old Scotland Yard, was it? Or New Scotland Yard, I forget. I remember walking into the recruiting office and the sergeant saying, "How old are you, Sonny?" And I said, 17. "You're too young to join the army," he said. "Go out and come back and tell me your right age." So I went back in and he said, "How old are you, son?" And I said, 18, Sergeant." "Right. We'll get you in the army." Now, this is one of the reasons, of course, on my record book, my date of birth is shown as 1919, so that I had actually committed a very small army crime of, putting my age on a year. Well, that was all right. I was asked what regiment I wanted to join. And first of all, I said I wanted the tank corps, because I was interested in tanks. And surprisingly enough, there were no vacancies, even at that time. No, I couldn't join the tank corps. I said, "What about the Royal Artillery?" No, there were no vacancies. And he said, "Where do you come from?" So I said, "Somerset." He said, "What about the Somerset Light Infantry?" And I said, "No, thank you very much, not the infantry. I at least not the light infantry. I'd seen them marching across Salisbury Plain at a rate of knots. So then he said, oh, what about the raw signals? That might suit you. So I said, oh, all right, raw signals. And so that was it. And I went with a small party, 10, 15 chaps, I suppose, who'd collected during the last week, I suppose, to make up the squad. And off we went to Catterick. And there I stayed until started my training, you know, the first training on the square, and then I'd already decided I wanted to be a wireless operator, and I was put into the wireless operating company at Catterick and trained there until the end of August 1939. And 1939, the reservists started to be called up. That was in August. So I suppose most of us knew that war was in the offing. I was posted to Bulford, to the 3rd Division signals, and then posted again to a signal section at Lark Hill, which was the 3rd Medium Regiment Royal Artillery signal section. And the officer commanding at that time was, or he became really quite famous, was 2nd Lieutenant A.J. Dean Drummond, who retired, well, many years later, as a Major General. He was a well-known Royal Signals character. He'd been to Arnhem. He'd won an MC at Arnhem. And I have seen him since. In fact, he was invited to speak to us at one of our airborne dinners that we held annually in Weston. Now, about just before Christmas 1940, we were stationed west of Douai, waiting to attack or for the attack, which never came. And one morning I became quite ill, and the regimental medical officer diagnosed appendicitis, and I eventually found myself in Dieppe, the number one general hospital, where I think it was on Christmas Eve 1940, I had my appendix removed. Since I'd left the 3rd Medium Regiment and I was adrift for more than 21 days, in those days your place was automatically refilled and you were posted back to the depot. And I went back to the depot at La Bulle, where eventually I was posted, strangely enough, to another medium artillery regiment, the 2nd, and they were stationed at Lille. Now, this was still during the period of the so-called phony war, and I suppose in the early spring, the regiment moved down to the Somme area around Albert for more training. And then it must have been early May of 1940, we moved back to the Lille area, and then on May the 10th, which was the day the Germans invaded Belgium, we moved over the border with the regiment and the rest, most of the BEF, and moved through Brussels and finally contacted the Germans at a place called Louvain.
Which division were you part of?
That was, well, originally we were 3rd Div, 3rd Division, but since we were a medium regiment, attached to a medium regiments were corps troops. They weren't actually in a particular division, but they were at the under the command of the corps commander, and a medium regiment could be posted, as it were, to support any division. The corps, we were one corps, actually, so you could say that we were one corps troops. I think that's how things worked out in those days.
What kind of positions did you move into in the Louvain area?
Well, we got as far as Louvain. I went in a wireless truck following the colonel. I was, at the time, I think the colonel's wireless operator. And we very quickly moved back because the Germans were coming into Louvain the other side. So we moved back perhaps 5 or 6 miles back towards Brussels and set up the gun positions there in a village overlooking Louvain. In fact, from our observation post, we could just see the on the outskirts of Louvain the famous Stella Artois brewery. Now that was the scene, really, I think, of the first contact with British troops. And our regiment at the time was supporting a guards battalion, and they actually moved forward, and there was some fighting around this brewery. I know I was on the telephone exchange back at this little village in a sort of half cellar under the house, and the colonel was in the same room giving his orders to the guns and so on. And I can well remember a message coming through from the forward observation officer to our CO asking for gunfire to be put down on to this brewery. The Germans were then occupying it, you see. And the colonel's famous remark was, "I'm not wasting my shells on those people." He said, "Haven't the guards still got bayonets?" And as far as I know, no shells were fired from those guns at all.
Seems an extraordinary remark.
Yeah. Well, they only carried a certain amount of ammunition. I suppose he thought it wasn't worth supporting, using his big shells to support this sort of operation. There were, must have been 25 pounders and that sort of thing around, you know. But he had been asked, and he said no. And I don't think the guns were ever fired in that position. In fact, as far as I know, the regiment, as a regiment, certainly didn't fire their guns. I think individual guns may have been fired later on, because we had this sort of stop-go business. And then we reached and went back through Brussels with all the guns in the transport. And of course it was a very different story when we moved back through Brussels, you know, whereas when we came up the other way towards the front, the Belgians were out cheering us on and thinking that it was going to be a walkover, I suppose. But when we came back, the situation was quite different.
In what sense?
Well, the streets were deserted, people were frightened. Instead of the cheering crowds, it was just deathly quiet in Brussels.
Did you come across any hostility from Belgians because of pulling out?
Not at all. Not at all. There were so few of them about. And I don't think Belgians moved in the same way that the French people moved from their houses, although there must have been some who were on the roads. On one occasion, coming on, but that was, I think, no, we were still in Belgium. There were a group of refugees going along the road, mixed up with Belgian troops, I suppose. And just before us, they were machine gunned from the air. And there were some people hit and killed. Well, then we moved on and came eventually. We still had our transport, but I don't know what happened to the guns. That's the signal still had their transport. And then when we got to Poperinge, we got there just at the time when the Stukas came over and bombed Poperinge, and a lot of houses and the factories around there were destroyed. A lot of dead animals around, a lot of trucks were destroyed. We just moved bypassed Poperinge, really, and just beyond Poperinge we were directed to the transport and so on, directed into a field, and we were told to destroy our wireless sets and everything that could be destroyed, the engines of the vehicles. The way of doing that was to let the oil out of the engines and then run the engines until they seized up. They did that with most of the transport. And then we took to the road with our rifles, the ones that had rifles, and then marched more or less from Poperinge to the outskirts of Dunkirk.
What was morale like by then?
We were all very unhappy, very sad to think that we were actually retreating, and we knew jolly well we were retreating. And we were pretty depressed, I can tell you. Most people were very depressed. The thought that the British Army was actually retreating after such a short time in action. We thought we could have done better than that.
Had you any sense that the British Army had been led into a trap in going into Belgium?
We knew nothing. We didn't hear that the Germans had broken through from the south and were virtually surrounding us. I think we were upset the Belgians hadn't led us over the border before they did, so that we could have at least prepared some sort of defence, you know, even trenches or something like that, strong points. But of course, no, the Belgians hadn't opened their borders to us, and we couldn't force our way over the borders until the Germans had actually set foot inside Belgium from the other side, which was pretty sad. Of course, the Belgians thought they were going to remain neutral, in the same way they started to think they were going to remain neutral in the Great War. But exactly the same thing happened. So you had the Germans coming at the British BEF from the north. The Germans had got broken through in the south, hadn't they, through the Sedan, and were rapidly moving up country. And it looked as though we would all be encircled. And of course, that's more or less what happened. Outside Dunkirk, as I say, I was still carrying a rifle, and about 30 of us from the regiment, including three Royal Signals attached, we were stopped by the roadside as we approached Dunkirk, and told to get into a couple of 1,500 weight trucks, two or three trucks were there, and we were driven from there to Newport, which is just beyond the border of Belgium and France. Newport, which is on the Yaiza River, the one that leads into the famous canals which go all over the place at Newport. And there we were put into, or told to occupy, the pilot station, which is on the edge of the sea. And the Belgians had made an attempt to dig a few trenches in the sand on the west side of the river. But as we approached this particular place, we were on foot by then, we'd been put off the trucks, and we walked towards the river. A number of the Belgian forces, army, had thrown away their weapons, and they were on the way back down the road towards Dunkirk. They'd obviously taken fright and had deserted. Anyway, we stayed there the night.
Was there any bitterness against the German against the Belgian army?
I don't think bitterness, really. We didn't think very much of them. We didn't think they were, or at least the ones we'd met, were particularly soldierly types. You know, they didn't look too well disciplined or anything like that. But we stayed in this place for the night, and then the next morning there was a bit of activity going on the other side. I think the Germans were gradually moving up with their artillery and the infantry, but nothing startling happened at all. We were just waiting for something to take place. We were all a bit put out because, of course, we discovered that instead of being actually in Dunkirk and perhaps on a boat going back to England, that we were the ones that had been selected to man the perimeter line which ran right the way round from where we were, right the right way round Dunkirk itself. One odd thing happened there, which what was I going to say about that? Oh, when these Belgian troops had passed us and gone, we noticed that they were by then unarmed. And in the morning, I was thinking to myself, well, I wonder what happened to all their arms. And when the tide, we were right by the sea there, of course, and when the tide went out, I discovered, or looked out, and saw various butts of rifles sticking out of the sand. And I walked down to the beach and found a machine gun, which I dragged out of the sand, and took that back to one of the officers and said, will this be any good to us cleaned up? Because we had no automatic weapons, you see. And he didn't think so. So I walked back again to where these rifles were and kicked around in the sand and found two brand new Browning automatic pistols, which I pocketed, one in each battle dress inside pocket. I took those away and quietly cleaned them up, and I thought, well, I'm keeping those as a souvenir. Well, then later on that day, some shells started to fly over us. I was in the upstairs room of this pilot station when one actually came through the window above my head and went out the back wall. And strange enough, I once saw a photograph of this hole on the east side of the pilot station in some publication, but I've never seen it since. There must be one in existence somewhere, with a soldier at the bottom with a tin hat pointing up at this hole. I think it was me saying, you know, that was the one that nearly got me. But it was obviously either a dud or an armour-piercing shell, because it didn't explode. It would have done it if it, because it hit the actual frame of the window before passing over my head. So that was immediately evacuated. Two of us were in the room, dashed down into the trenches. We saw a few Germans over the other side. We had a few shots at them, long distance. And then I think we were there, oh, when I came out, they started, the salvo came over, and I was very slightly wounded in the arm, and another chap was hit in the chest. They evacuated him. We stayed, I suppose, perhaps for 3 or 4 days, scrounging, you know, food to eat, the odd tin of sardines, the odd tin of bully, the odd packet of biscuits. And then a section of infantry came up, not more than a half a company, and they said to us, right, you boys can go now, you know, we're the ones that have got to stay.
So you were a signals unit acting in an infantry role?
Well, yes, in the artillery way, of course, as well. Which was a little bit unusual. But I suppose at Dunkirk they grabbed anyone that had got a rifle, you see.
Who was this infantry unit?
I don't know. One of the county regiments. But I don't know who they were. But I'm told afterwards they all escaped as well. They all got away. Because we thought when we left, all the poor devils, you know, they're the ones that have got to stay and hold the line. But as it happened, I believe that virtually everyone on the perimeter line got away, minus their equipment, of course, and guns, everything they had, virtually. Well, we marched from the Yaiser, the river, we started back towards Dunkirk, because we'd been told that's where the evacuation was taking place. And we'd started off on the road, and that was being shelled as we came down that road from Newport, the main road from Newport. So we decided, or someone decided, we all followed, onto the sands. And we got onto the sands somewhere around Le Pan, and then walked along the sands to a place which I think is or was Bray Dunes, and there we saw in the distance that Dunkirk was ablaze. The oil tanks were ablaze, various ships had been hit, and no one could then, and the mole had been destroyed, I believe. That's where most of the troops, in the first instance, had been evacuated from. So there was no point in going into Dunkirk, so we stayed in these enormous queues at the seaside, you know, waiting for the little ships and the lifeboats to come in and out to take us off.
What did the beaches look like?
Oh, absolutely crowded. But very orderly queues of soldiers waiting to take their chance, wait for the lifeboat or small boats to come in and take them off to the bigger ships that were out at sea. No large ships could come in at all, because of course it was a very shelving beach, and also the sandbags.